Last couple of weeks, we've been following the story of redemption through Scripture. We've been tracing out this narrative that ties all the different stories that we find in the Bible together into a cohesive whole. And if you've not been with us the last couple of weeks, I'm going to try and catch you up in about 30 seconds. We began at creation, where God makes everything, the universe, the world, the garden, humanity, and he puts humanity in the garden, and he gives humanity everything that is necessary for life. He gives them vocation and purpose and calling, and he gives them incredible freedom. And then he gives them boundaries within which to explore that freedom. The problem is, we didn't trust him. When God said, eat this and live, eat this and die, we just didn't believe him. And even in the garden, even in paradise, you still have to live by faith. You still have to take God at his word. Before there was any other sin, there was unbelief. And on the heels of unbelief comes death and disorder, until we get to the story of Noah, and God actually is remorseful for creating humanity in the world. He looks down and he says, I wish I hadn't done that. Because every inclination of the thoughts of the hearts of men was only wicked always. And the question is, does the story go on? Will God rescue his creation that he made good but has fallen into death and brokenness? Is God going to pick up the pieces? The good news from the story of Noah is, yes, he will. The next question is, if he does save his creation, what sort of relationship could a perfect God have with a broken world? And what we learn is that it's a relationship of covenant. It is God binding himself to the world that he has made. It is God embracing the very thing that has grieved his heart so deeply. What's incredible about this is that he does it in spite of man's sinfulness. You see, we learn a lot about sinfulness. First, the flood doesn't take care of the problem of sin. The flood doesn't wash sinfulness away, because sinfulness was not just an act in time. It wasn't just a decision in our past. No, no. Sinfulness is a condition that we live in. It's almost biological. It gets passed from one generation to the next. It's like a disease. And Noah had the virus. And so did his kids. And so they come off the boat, and there's still the same problem there was before. And yet God says, even though man is wicked from his youth, I'm still going to hold on to him. I'm still going to embrace this thing that I've made, even though it's gone so wrong. So we come to chapter 12 in Genesis, and understand, in Genesis chapter 12, the whole story takes this really, really dramatic shift. In chapters 1 to 11, the stage on which the drama is acted out is so big. It's cosmic in scale. It's creation. It's everything. It's the world. And every decision has implications for everyone. And the actors are larger than life. It's Adam and Eve, the parents of all of humanity. And it's the only guy who survives the flood. And the story's so big, and yet we get to chapter 11 and the stage seems to shrink down. It's a lot more local now. And the characters don't seem so large or heroic anymore. It's just some guy named Abram. You don't even know who he is. Nobody knows who he is. He's just some guy, some wandering Aramean. There's nothing special about him. He's not royalty. He's not the last righteous man on earth. Like, no, he's just some guy. The only thing different about Abram is that God has chosen him. God has called him. God is going to invite him to be a part of this plan of redemption that is about to begin to unfold. Not only does the stage shrink, not only are the characters a little more commonplace, but there's a significant shift in theme. In the first 11 chapters, what's the problem? Well, the problem is death. God created life, but we sinned. We didn't believe him. And when we sin, death enters in. And sin perpetuates itself. And the more people there are, the more wickedness there is, and the more wickedness seems to flourish. The problem is sin. God created the world good, and we broke it. But when you get to chapter 12, it's like we're not talking about sin anymore. It's almost not even in view. In fact, you read through the whole story of Abraham. I never saw this before this week. You read through the whole story of Abraham, there's almost no talk about sin at all. Though he certainly has character flaws, that comes through in the story. But it's almost as if the focus has shifted. And then I remembered the story of Adam and Eve in the very beginning. Before there was any other sin, there was unbelief. They simply did not believe what God said. And so it's as if in the story of Abraham, God's not focusing on sin and righteousness and wickedness. He's focusing on something more fundamental. It's as if the one question that always seems to be in view, no matter where you're at in the story, is this: will you trust me? In spite of everything else, will you choose to believe me? And so we'll pick up chapter 12. Now the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." What we have here is really two things. One is a promise of blessing, but that is embedded in a call to go. That's significant, the call. Go from your country, the place you know, the place that is familiar, the place where people look at you and say, "Oh, we know him. He's from here. He's one of us. He belongs here. This is his home too." Go to a place where they won't know you. Well, they'll look at you and say, "We don't know him. He's not from here. Maybe he doesn't belong here. Leave your country. And leave your kindred." The people you love, that you know, that are familiar, but it's more than that. At this time, it's the safety net. There's a social obligation amongst kindred. Like, if something bad happens to you, it is your family's obligation to help out. There is safety in the numbers of the tribe and of the clan. So leave the people you know and the people you love, the people you're connected to, and leave all of the safety that comes with having family around you, all those support structures that you've gotten used to and depend on. Leave it all behind. Leave your country, leave your kindred, leave your father's house. It is difficult to explain the significance of this. The father's house, I mean, that's his place. But it's more than that. It's tied into his identity. He doesn't really know who he is outside of his connection back to the father's house. And if he's going to take off and leave, there's going to be people in the house, because he's the firstborn, he's the next one in line to take over the father's house. They're going to say, "Wait a minute, we were depending on you. We were anticipating your leadership. You're supposed to take care of us." The father's house, it's his hopes, his dreams. It's everything he imagined that his life could become. All of that he imagined within the context of what the house could be under his leadership. So God is asking Abraham to leave everything: the familiar, the safe, his dream. "Well, where are we going, God?" "I'll tell you when we get there. To a land I'll show you." Wait, what? You're asking me to leave everything I know behind, Everything. You're not even going to tell me where I'm going. I got to give up everything to go to some strange place. I can't do a cost-benefit analysis. I can't weigh the pros and cons because I don't know where I'm going. And I've got to give up everything to go to this place and I don't know where it's at. Just because you say, if I go, you'll bless me. That it'll be better when I get there than what I have right now. Do you trust me? Will you believe? Will you live by the promise, even if you have to risk everything? So Abraham went. Abram went as the Lord told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Abram took Sarai, his wife, Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered and the people that they had acquired in Haran. They set out to go to the land of Canaan. When they came to the land of Canaan, Abram passed through the land to the place at Shechem, to the oaks of Moreh. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring, I will give this land. That's the key promise right there. Everything for the rest of the story is going to revolve around that promise. To your offspring, I will give this land. But don't miss the context that God speaks the promise into. The Canaanites are in the land. Go figure. You get to Canaan, here are the Canaanites occupying the land, owning the land, living in the land. And God says, to your offspring, I will give this land. This is a really good promise for Abraham to keep to himself. You don't go to your new neighbors and knock on the door. Hi, I'm Abram. I just moved into the neighborhood. God's going to give your land to my offspring. Don't say that. Keep your mouth shut. But you can see in just a moment, the promise gets a lot more complicated, doesn't it? Because Abraham's brought into this kind of tenuous relationship with the Canaanites. I mean, they have possession of the land, and yet the promise is for the land to go to his offspring. And so he's in the midst of a reality that seems to deny the potential promise. But it's even more complicated than that. One, because he doesn't actually have any offspring yet. Who's the land going to go to? But he's also beginning to realize that the promise, well, it's a lot bigger than he is, isn't it? God's making the sort of promises to Abraham. God's calling Abraham to live his whole life by a promise that he'll never see the fulfillment of. He won't get to see the end of this thing. When he dies, nobody's going to know his name. He's not going to be in possession of the land. It's for his offspring. Could you live by a promise that God made to you if it was bigger than you and you knew you would not see it fulfilled in your lifetime? Can you imagine if God made this sort of promise to an American? I don't know who'd take him up on it. Why? We don't live for the promise of tomorrow. We live for the promise of today. We like instant gratification. Microwaves are not fast enough for us. I don't know anybody who's living for something beyond what they can see in their own lifespan. I mean, maybe we sacrifice today for what we believe to be some good golden years when we finally retire and we want to have a comfortable retirement and do all the things that we couldn't do while we were working. And so we save and we plan for that. And maybe when we're gone, the kids get something. But who's living for something any bigger than that? Who's investing and sacrificing for a future that will not come to fruition until your grandchildren's grandchildren come around? If the promise is bigger than you in your life, could you live for it? Abraham seems to. To your offspring I will give this land. So Abram built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. He builds an altar to the Lord and he calls on the name, the Lord is God. He believes. He worships. He trusts. But at every turn in the story, it seems that Abraham's trust in God and in the promises of God is always put to the test. That question comes back. Will you still trust me? Will you still believe? Because no sooner does Abram get to the land than there's a famine. And because there's a famine, Abraham has some pretty terrible options in front of him. First option is he can stay in the land and everybody starves to death. Not really a viable option. The other option is to do what all the Canaanites are going to do, run to Egypt. Because Egypt's a little more famine resistant than the rest of the world around them because of the Nile River. Every year the Nile floods, and that's actually a really good thing, these floods, because it not only brings water up onto the ground, but it also brings the sediment and the nutrients. And so wherever the Nile floods was incredibly fertile. And then they had figured out in the ancient world how to irrigate off the Nile and water their fields. And so when the rest of the world was going through drought and famine, Egypt was fine. And so everybody flocks to Egypt whenever there was trouble. And the Egyptians hated this. They hated this. They looked down on all of these ruffians coming to their country. There's an inscription in a very prominent general's tomb that describes the wandering Asiatics, the people of the East, who always come to Egypt whenever there's trouble because they've not learned how to live and take care of themselves. And so these are his options. Abraham either stays and starves or he goes to Egypt and he becomes persona non grata. But even that's a little more complicated because he's going with a beautiful wife. And understand how the world works. When a king or a man in power saw something he wanted, he just took it. That's what power was. You just took what you wanted. So if you see a beautiful woman, you take her. If she has a husband, you kill him to get him out of the way. And so these are his choices. Do I stay and starve, or do I go to Egypt where they'll kill me and take my wife? God, I thought you said you were going to bless me. I thought you said you were going to make me a great nation. I thought you said you were going to make my name great. And these are the choices I'm left with. What sort of land is this that you think you're going to give to my offspring? So Abraham, being the smart guy he thinks he is, comes up with a third option. He said, we'll go to Egypt because they are the only ones with food. But when we get there, I want you, my wife, to tell them that you're my sister. And technically, it wasn't a lie. She was his half-sister. It wasn't uncommon to intermarry in the clan at this time. And so this was his father's daughter by another wife. And so technically she was his sister. It just wasn't the whole truth. So they go to Egypt, and everybody notices how beautiful she is. Pharaoh hears about it, inquires of her, oh, I'm his sister, and she gets taken off and put in Pharaoh's harem. Abraham has managed to save his skin, and note, how well this has actually turned out for him, because not only does Pharaoh take her, but he begins to shower Abram with gifts. He gives him flocks and herds and animals and servants. He acts very gracious towards him, and Abraham's thinking like, wow, this worked out all right. They were going to take my wife anyway. At least now I'm getting rich. So he saved his life. He's advanced his status. The only problem is he's jeopardized the promise, hasn't he? Your offspring will have the land. We can't have offspring if Pharaoh has your wife. And what we know is we cheat ahead in this story is it's not just a promise to Abraham, but it's part of a bigger plan of God redeeming all of creation. Now all of a sudden that plan is jeopardized. Because probably just like us, Abraham is willing to gamble away the future for his immediate security. You got to fight to live another day. So if these are the options I have, I take the best one that keeps me alive. What Abraham needs to learn is that the God who makes the promise has a vested interest in seeing it through. He's the God of the promise, he's the God of the unseen, but he's also the God of the unimagined. Our imaginations are so small. There are 1,000 different ways God, with his infinite mind and power, could have resolved this conflict if Abraham would have just trusted him. But instead, he settled for the options he could see in front of him, and he jeopardizes the future for his immediate survival. The story is not really as much about Abraham as it is about God and how faithful God is. I've met a lot of people that have wondered about past mistakes. They said, you know, I believe that God has a plan for my life. I believe God has a purpose. But if I'm being honest, I've really screwed some stuff up in my life. I've done some really, really stupid stuff. Have I wrecked God's plan forever? I think the story says no. What we see is a God who gets involved in keeping the plan together. So God shows up, he begins to pour out plagues on Pharaoh's house. Pharaoh didn't even know. Somehow he figures it out. The text doesn't tell us how, but he figures out, wait a minute, this woman that came in, when she got into the harem, all of a sudden all these plagues are here, and somehow he discerns that she's not his sister, she's his wife. Gives him back to Abraham. Abraham's like, well, technically she is my... Abraham, stop talking. You're not going to help your case with Pharaoh. He doesn't care about technicalities. He cares about plagues. Pharaoh says, take your wife and go. He sends armed guards and escorts them out of the country. And God rescues the rescue plan in spite of Abraham. It's a story about who God is and how faithful he is. And if it's really God's plan, you can't mess it up. You can't mess that up. So Abraham and his family and all of his flocks and herds, now they go back to the promised land, to Canaan. But what they quickly discover is that they now have too many flocks and herds. Lot has sheep, he's got sheep, and the problem is the land they're living on will not sustain all of it. They've grown too numerous. And so Abraham goes to Lot and says, look, we shouldn't be fighting about this. Let's make an agreement. Let's split the land between us. If you want to go right, I'll go left. If you go north, I'll go south. I'll let you decide. Now, Abraham's being the gentleman, but Lot should really defer to his elder. That would be his social obligation. Lot should look back to Abraham and say, oh, thank you for your generosity, but you decide. Or Lot should survey the land and say, this is the best land, so I'll take this. Abraham, you keep it. You're the elder. You're the head of this household. You make the decision. But he doesn't do that. He surveys the land. He looks down to the Jordan River Valley, and it's lush, and it's green, and it's good land. Scripture says it was like the land of Eden. And Lot says, I think I'll take that. And Abraham remains in the hill country. I wonder if Abraham began to regret his generosity, his kindness. If he's worried about living with the consequences of his actions. But God shows up immediately after and says, Abraham, Abraham, look north and south and east and west, as far as you can see. As far as you can see, all of it, I will give to your offspring. And your offspring is going to be as numerous as the stars and as the sand. God comes to him again with more promises. He says, Abraham, I'm your shield. I take care of you. I'm going to give this land to your offspring. And it's been a while now, and so Abraham kind of looks at God and says, what do you think you can give me? You keep talking about giving land to my offspring, but I don't have any offspring. Right now my heir is some guy who's not my son. So what do you think that you can give me until I have that? God says, I will give you an heir. I will give you a son, and I will multiply him. You will be the father of nations. Do you believe me? Will you trust me? And Abraham believed God. And the text says it was counted to him as righteousness that he trusted God, that he believed, that he had faith. And then something incredible happens. As soon as Abraham believes, he has this kind of crazy vision. You need to go read about it. But God comes down and he makes a covenant with Abraham. God binds himself to Abraham. God embraces Abraham's future. I will be your God. He obligates himself to Abraham forever. Do you know what happens next? Nothing. I mean a whole lot of nothing. The years just keep ticking by. Nothing. And I have to believe that as Abraham walked through the valley of the shadow of doubt, he began to wonder if, did I hear God right? Was that just some like crazy dream I had? Was that all up in my head because I thought God promised me offspring, but he didn't? I've tried to help my wife understand that sometimes there's a huge gap between the promise and its fulfillment. I always promised to do things around the house for her, and months later she's like, why hasn't this been done? Honey, the Bible teaches that sometimes there's a big gap between the promise and its fulfillment. I'm trying. It's terrible. Do you still believe? I think Abraham's faith was tested, and him and Sarah kind of come up with a plan of their own. God said he would give us a child, but it's not working out. Sarah says, well, I got this slave girl. Why don't you have a kid with her? Every time Abraham kind of takes the promise into his own hands, and every time Abraham tries to make something happen in his life, spoiler alert, it never ends well. I'll let you read the story of Hagar and Ishmael, but it doesn't end well for him. So God comes back and says, no, 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 no. I'm going to give you a son by your wife, Sarah. God comes back around a second time to kind of announce that this is now going to take place, and Sarah overhears and she laughs at God, and God like calls her out on it, like, why are you laughing? Oh, I didn't laugh. Yeah, you did. I think sometimes we look down on Sarah like, oh, she just didn't have faith. But man, if we were there, we'd all be laughing right alongside of her. Sarah's like 90 years old. I want you to think of your grandmother. I mean, your old grandmother, I mean, 90, can you imagine her getting pregnant? Of course she's laughing. God shows up and says, you're going to have a baby. She's like, have a baby? I was thinking about having a hip replacement. 90-year-old women do not have babies. It don't work that way. She's been barren her whole life. Will you believe? I can't imagine how this conversation goes. I mean, I've had it a couple times, but I'm at the right age. Your wife comes, you're like, I think I'm pregnant. How does a 9-year-old woman say that? Think I'm pregnant? Not really sure. Never done this before. 90 years old. Can you imagine the joy? I mean the unspeakable joy that they have to have when she actually gets pregnant. I mean, this is miracle of miracles, right? I mean, she gets pregnant, she has a baby at 90 years of age, in their old age, and oh, they just love this kid. And understand what he represents. I mean, this is the promise in the flesh. This is the fulfillment. This is everything Abraham believed against hope and against all the odds. And now he has it in his hand. And he says, oh, God is good. God is faithful. God fulfills all of his promises. I have the promise in my hand. It's a great story. Until chapter 22. God shows up again. Text says, this time to test Abraham. Abraham, I'm here, God. Take your son. Your only son. The one you love. I want you to go to this mountain. I'll show you when you get there. I want you to offer him as a burnt sacrifice. Now again, we know how the story ends, most of us, so we lose the sense of drama. But imagine if you're reading this for the first time. Man, all of a sudden, these questions I had back with the story of Noah, they're all coming right back again. Like, wait, whoa, whoa, what sort of God is this? What sort of terrible test is... We need to be honest, church. This is a hard passage because so much of what this passage says doesn't seem to resonate with what we think we know about God from all the rest of Scripture. Why would he do that? And I don't know if I should be shocked and appalled or inspired by Abraham's response. The dude doesn't blink. God shows up and says, kill your son as a human sacrifice, and the dude doesn't blink. He just sets out obeying. I don't know if that should have us really nervous, or I don't know, maybe that's what happens when you've walked with God in faith and you've for so long had to believe in the promises that whenever God speaks, you just do it now. I don't know. And what the text doesn't tell us, but I think allows us to speculate, is the sort of internal angst that Abraham has to be feeling. How would you feel if everything you'd ever hoped and dreamed for and everything you'd believed for has been put in your hands and now it seems God himself is going to take it away? Anybody who told you the life of faith and living by promise was easy. He's trying to sell something. And so he gives his son, when he asks about the sacrifice for the worship that Abraham says they're going to go perform, where's the sheep? God will provide. What else do you say? God will provide. So Abraham takes his son, his future, his dreams, everything. And he binds it up. And he lays it before God. And he reaches for the knife. I can't imagine. We know how the story ends. An angel calls from heaven, Abraham, stop, stop. Don't hurt the boy. I understand now that you fear me, that you love me more than anything else, that you wouldn't even withhold your only son from me. And God provides a ram. And he gives his son back to him, and because you wouldn't withhold him from me, because you would give even your son to me, I'll take what you've given, I'm going to multiply it, and I'm going to bless him. And he will bless the world. I don't know the final interpretation, the right interpretation for this story. It's a hard story. I wonder if maybe God knows that sometimes if we're handed that which is promised to us, we'd settle for that and we'd stop pursuing the one who makes the promises. What if it's more important that we stay connected to the one who has made covenant with us than we actually receive what is promised? I don't know. Can you believe? Will you trust me? That's the heart of the story, one end to the other. Will you believe if it costs you everything to follow? Would you risk it all on a promise? Do you believe? Can you believe if the promise is bigger than you, if you discover that you won't see the end of this thing? Can you keep living your life by that promise? Can you give your whole self to it, even though it'll only be fulfilled down the road? Can you believe in all the circumstances of your life tell you that the promise is unlikely and probably not going to come to fruition? Can you continue to believe when all you can see in front of you are bad options and you can't even begin to imagine how this works out? When your very life seems to be threatened, can you live by the promise then? Can you live by the promise when it's slow in coming? When you begin to question whether you really heard what you thought you heard. Could you believe if it seemed like God Himself has taken it back from you? Can you, like Abraham, say, I don't see the end of this thing, but I believe that God provides. I believe that God provides. That's the question to us this morning. Before anything else, we have to square with the question of faith. And it's not the sort of question that you settle at the beginning of your journey and then you just get on with. Abraham's on a journey his whole life, and the question keeps coming up again and again and again. Will you believe? I suspect this morning some of us came in with some stuff that is challenging our belief. It's made us wonder. So Cody's going to come and we're going to close in worship. But maybe you just take this time to talk between you and God. Maybe this is a moment where you bring the things that challenge your faith to God and say, God, I believe, but help my unbelief. Because we know that even faith is a gift. Maybe this morning there's some things you've been holding on to. Hopes, dreams, children. The future. And you've been clinging to them so desperately, and maybe what you're hearing this morning is God say, you need to lay it on the altar. You need to trust me even with that. I gave it to you, but can you give it back? As we worship, maybe you sing along, but maybe for you this morning it's a time of prayer. That your faith may grow, or that which you hold on to can be laid down, but church, we never get away from this. Today, will you walk in faith? Today, will you believe?